Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com. That's AbilityChiro.com.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader. Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
The Book Program. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to The Book Show. Back with us is Keith Stewart. He's an author and journalist whose heartwarming debut novel, A Boy Made of Blocks, was a Richard and Judy Book Club pick and a major bestseller. It was inspired by Keith's real-life relationship with his autistic son. His latest novel, Days of Wonder, is a tale about growing up, the beauty of a father and daughter bond, and finding magic in everyday life. Also back with us is T.M. Logan, who's the author of the best-selling psychological thriller Lies that was published last year. It sold more than 300,000 copies in the UK. His new book, 29 Seconds, is about Sarah, who's in an impossible situation at work. She's being sexually harassed and bullied by her boss, who makes it quite clear that he can destroy her career unless she gives him what he wants. And finally on tonight's book show is Lydia Sisson, who began her career as a BBC World Service radio producer. She's written three critically acclaimed historical novels for young adults, each in some way inspired by the radical backgrounds of earlier generations of her family. Mr. Peacock's Possessions explores timeless themes of family relationships, faith and belonging. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning, the pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else can speak the words on your lips. Drench yourself in words unspoken. Live your
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Keith Stewart. He's an author and journalist. His heartwarming debut novel, A Boy Made of Blocks, came out a couple of years ago when he joined us on the book show. It was a Richard and Judy Book Club pick and a major bestseller and was inspired by Keith's real-life relationship with his autistic son. His latest novel is Days of Wonder. It's a story about love, life and magic. It's about a father and his daughter who discover that stories can save lives. Welcome to the book show, Keith.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, pleasure. It's great to have you back on the show. And I'm pleased, very pleased to hear that A Boy Made of Blocks did so well, because I thought it was such a lovely story.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, I had really no idea how it would do and if it would kind of touch people. I guess you never know with books, and because it was so heavily based on, in a lot of ways, my own experiences, I had lots of worries that it wouldn't transfer, but luckily it seems to have done. So I think we sold around 200,000 copies in the UK alone, which is amazing.
Oh, that's fantastic. And for people who don't know the story, can you just say a little bit about it?
So, yeah, Boy Made of Blocks was about father of an autistic child called Sam, and the father Alex is kind of, there's a lot of frustration and anger in their house, and he has to leave the home. His wife Jodie kind of says to him, you have to get yourself sorted out before you can help me and Sam deal with our lives. And so he has to find a new way to recommunicate or make touch with his autistic son, and he does so through the video game Minecraft. They play online together, and that helps them forge a relationship, and it's all about how the video game helps them really discover each other as people, really.
Yeah, and how much of it was based on your own experiences with your son?
I think the overarching kind of narrative wasn't really ours, but there were lots of things that happened in the book which were drawn from our experiences. Things that Sam had to face were things that my son Zach had to face as well. The difficulty with social communication and being in social situations. There's lots of scenes in the book where Sam is in children's parties or he's in the park and he has difficulties in those situations. Anything unpredictable, Sam finds really difficult, and that's very much similar to Zach. So I think there were lots of situations that we faced as a family that I think that we drew from, but the overarching story is very much a fiction.
Yes. So the new book, a very different set of characters, a very different crisis, but you did want to write another novel about families in crisis, didn't you?
Yeah, definitely. Because I found it really interesting writing Boy Made of Blocks and looking at the kind of different dynamics within a family, especially when things kind of go wrong or, atypical things happen to the family, like crises that are completely unavoidable and everyone just has to deal with them. And I think that sort of dynamic, you know, you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family, really. So things that happen in your family, they can bring up lots of tensions. And I find that really interesting. So, yeah, I definitely wanted to kind of explore that again.
So tell us a bit about your protagonist. Her name is Hannah.
That's it, yes. So, yeah, Hannah is she's 15, and she suffers from a condition known as cardiomyopathy, which is a fault, really, in the lining of the heart. It thickens the lining of the heart and makes it very difficult for the heart to pump, and it can lead to lots of different sub-conditions, arrhythmia, for example, so it's an irregular heartbeat, and it's usually congenital, it's there from birth, and often children with cardiomyopathy might never experience any symptoms, but some, unfortunately, the symptoms can be very, very severe, and it's a condition where often you read these stories of children, unfortunately, teenagers sometimes dying during sporting events, and it turns out they had an undiagnosed heart condition, and I just found those stories really kind of tragic and moving. And so I thought, what would it be like to be a teenager and face that kind of sense of mortality and uncertainty? And how would you deal with that? And how would your parents deal with it? And really, that was the kind of starting point of the book, really.
I think the idea of having something that isn't diagnosed, that you don't know that you have, is, well, I was going to say it's a worry, but if you don't know about it, it's not a worry. But as you say, very tragic when we hear of these stories.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the difference, what I've done with this book, is that they do find out. They go to the doctor when Hannah is about four and her heart condition is diagnosed at that stage, which can sometimes happen. I was really lucky that I spoke to an amazing consultant cardiologist at Great Ormond Street Hospital, Matthew Fenton, who helped me considerably get the medical details of the story right. And he said that sometimes it is diagnosed early. So actually this family, Hannah and her father, Tom, do know from quite an early age that she has this heart condition. And really that's what shapes their lives. Tom is a theatre director. He's the manager of a local theatre. And he uses the theatre and its amateur dramatics group.
Yes,
he uses them,
group.
Really, to every year they put on a little play for her just to kind of help her through her yearly visits to the cardiomyopathy specialists. And it's really about that. It's really about how Tom and Hannah try to find the magic in the moments of their lives to cope with this incoming threat to her.
It's interesting that you've put her in the theatre situation to grow up in. I like that you've done that. You're an ex-drama student yourself, I understand.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've always loved acting. I did acting at O-level back when O-levels were a thing. I did A-level in drama, and I studied drama at university. And, being part of a group of actors, it's a really kind of special, interesting relationship. And it's like unlike any other relationship, really. They're so kind of intimate and close, but yet, often you'll be working together on a play and you'll meet, and then 6 months later, everybody will be almost strangers again. But I thought I was really interested in the dynamic of an amateur production group working in a theatre and getting to know each other for years and years and years. And it's really them that bring up Hannah. So yeah, I'm really interested in the kind of dynamics of the theatre and the fact that theatre is still massively relevant now, even though we have the internet and television and cinema. You can still go to a play or a musical and it can be completely transformative. And I find that really fascinating. The relationship that you get between an audience and an actor on a stage is completely unique. And that's what kind of, in some ways, what I wanted to explore.
Yeah, and working with people in the theatre, as you say, even if it's for a short space of time, a few months, they become like family.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what the book is about. It's about how Hannah discovers her family in this drama group, and they act almost as kind of brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts and grandparents in a lot of ways. I'm really interested in the idea of kind of unconventional families that are brought together through situations rather than through kind of genetics in a way. And I love the idea of people forming their own families and their own support groups. And I think this group, this amateur theatre group, becomes, her family. And there's lots of subplots in the book about what happens with the other characters in the group, especially her friend Margaret, who's like an 80-year-old woman who tells them all she was an actor in the 50s and 60s, and no one knows whether that's true or not. And she has this relationship with her, and Hannah's 15, but Margaret is 80, but they kind of share this, I don't know, this almost kind of not cynical, sceptical detachment from life. They both see it in a similar way.
Lovely. I like that. So how does Hannah cope with her diagnosis? Does she understand what's going on?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what I wanted to do was just show how the two characters cope in a different way. And for Hannah, she becomes very kind of blasé about it and very almost dismissive of it and cynical about it. And she makes kind of lots of kind of cynical jokes about mortality and about what's going to happen to her. And that's how she copes. Whereas her father finds it very, very difficult to look at the condition head on. And he tries to create this sort of sense of magic and wonder around everything that they do, almost to keep Hannah from the truth. So they have very different ways of coping. And I really wanted to look at how those kind of clash but how they also at times work together, converge to help them out. And they get to, obviously the book gets to a crisis point and really you start to discover which of these methods of coping is really going to work.
I imagine it was quite a moving book for you to write at times.
It was really hard to write. It was very, very difficult. I got very it sounds really it's funny when you often hear authors, because I'm a very new author, and you often hear them talking about how close they got to their characters, and I always thought that's ridiculous because you wrote them, but you spend so much time in their headspace, and I spent so much time thinking about Hannah and Tom, and I agonized over every single chapter of the book and every single interaction between them. And so yeah, it was really difficult, and it's very like I really like to draw out the humour in every situation. I believe there is humour and light and laughter, even in the darkest situations. As humans, that's how we cope and deal with things. So for me, actually, one of the hardest things was making sure it was still funny. And, luckily, I've started to get early reviews back from bloggers now, and people are finding it a funny book. And that's what I wanted. It's a really tragic, difficult situation to write about. And I didn't want people to see it, just like I didn't want people to see Boy Made of Blocks as like an issues book. I wanted them to enjoy the emotional ride. That's definitely what I want with this book. I want it to be a book about laughter and fun and love and family, not really just about a medical condition.
Yeah, and I guess for you as an author, if you're writing a story and you're laughing yourself or you're getting emotional, then for sure that's going to come across to the readers.
Yeah, I hope so. It's really difficult. You never know quite what's going to hit and what isn't. There were definitely bits in Boy Made of Blocks which were really interesting. Since the book came out, and I've been and I've talked to book groups and I've met people that have read it, and there have been things in the book that people have laughed at or enjoyed that I didn't quite realise that they were going to take in the way that they did. And there's some elements that people found sad that I didn't realise they would either. So I think that's the beauty of novels, really. You put out, the author only puts out their version of the story, and every reader brings their own life into it. So there are definitely, the way I structure the book, I'm really aware of planting jokes and repeated jokes and things like that, and subtly within the dialogue, and always hoping that will come off. But yeah, you never really know.
It must be wonderful though to get such great feedback from readers. I know that A Boy Made of Blocks has had over 1,000 five-star Amazon reviews. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's incredible, and I never really. You know, you never really know how people are going to take what you do, and you just hope for the best. And I come from like a journalistic background where, you know, I write for The Guardian, I've written for The Guardian for 15 years. And when you put a story online, a news story online, and you know the comments underneath are usually going to be quite negative. You know, that's just the reality I deal with it. So actually getting positive feedback has been kind of a real shock. It's been a real shock. But it's just really lovely. And every time, you know, I've been to lots of festivals and talked about the book, and people come up to me afterwards, and often it'll be parents who have an autistic child or child on the autism spectrum, and they'll say to me that, you know, they've given the book to friends and relatives to help them understand the condition. And that's just, you know, it's just amazing. It's just a staggering thing to happen. I don't know what will happen with Days of Wonder, but I've already received a couple of messages from people who have experience of heart conditions, and they've said that they felt the story kind of replicates the emotional journey they went on. And you know, again, that's profound to me, because I haven't been on that journey really. You know, I have a son on the autism spectrum, and I kind of understood it, but with Hannah's condition, I really relied on Matthew Fenton's medical expertise at Great Ormond Street, but also, you know, my own imagination and ability to empathise, I guess.
Yeah, it is an added bonus, isn't it, really, to write a book that people get something from and enjoy, just from an entertainment perspective, I guess, is one thing, but also for people to learn something or to really get something from the book is something else.
I think so, and that's what I think I'll always try to do, and that's what I've always tried to do with when I've written about video games, which sounds really silly, but I've always treated video games as something, as, you know, important cultural artifacts and the things that you can learn from. And I think actually almost any novel that you enjoy will take you on a kind of a journey which is partly emotional but also partly educational. You know, whatever you read, if you enjoy it and you respond to it, you've learned something, I think. So. So it's a really difficult balance, because I really wanted people to understand Hannah's condition, but I didn't want them to be overcome by medical data.
And no.
There are a couple of hospital visits, and those are really, really difficult to write, because you can get completely engrossed in the, or you know, almost like a ER or casualty, you can become engrossed in the medical detail, and then the story becomes something very different.
Mm.
So yeah, it's a fine balance between entertaining and educating. But
yeah.
I always seem to be going along.
Well, if people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called Days of Wonder, and it's by Keith Stewart, who we've been chatting to today. Keith, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is T.M. Logan, or Tim Logan. His debut thriller, Lies, was a number one ebook bestseller. It has sold over 300,000 copies across paperback and ebook. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest compelling twisty page turner. It's called 29 Seconds. Welcome to the book show, Tim.
Hi, hello, thank you for having me.
Pleasure, thanks for joining us. So how was it after the success of Lies? Were you nervous about the follow-up?
Yeah, I think there's always an element of that kind of difficult second album syndrome, because Lies had been seemed to take off in such a way that no one really expected, and so to follow that up was a little bit daunting. But on the other hand, you feel like you've kind of done it once, so you feel a bit more confident about doing it again. So it was a kind of a bit of both, really.
And for people who haven't read Lies, can you just say a little bit about what happens in the book?
So basically, Lies is a psychological thriller, as you said, about an ordinary guy. So one day he's driving home from work and he sees his wife's car, not where he expects it to be. And so he follows her, is going to say hello. She meets up with a family friend. They have an argument, and things kind of spiral out of control from that point, from that one chance meeting. His whole life kind of starts to unravel as he realizes that lots of things, including his relationship and his friendships, are really not what they seemed at all. So it's kind of a fast-paced thriller, and it's been incredible to see how well it's done last year. So,
and is it possible to try and understand why you think people enjoyed it so much? Have people said, and have you understood why?
I suppose you do talk to people, and I read some of the reviews, and I think people like the fact that the pace is very quick. It doesn't really let up. There's no, I try to tend to leave out the bits that I think people are going to skip over. So it's kind of a fairly twisty turny. So there's lots of surprises along the way, and it kind of, the momentum is kind of there throughout the whole story, I think. So I think that's one of the reasons why people really sort of took it to their hearts and probably told friends about it. And I think that's one of the ways it's kind of, the word of mouth has really helped it.
Yeah.
To get the visibility it did.
So did you want to do a similar thing with 29 Seconds?
Yeah, that's the intention. I mean, again, what I've tried to do is surprise people and write a story that people really can't stop reading, and that's the sort of book that I like to read. When I want to go to bed earlier at night so I can read more, or when I'm trying to when it's distracting me from doing other things because it's so kind of compelling. That's the kind of thing. That's the kind of book that I wanted to write with 29 Seconds to sort of. It's a different story, but it's kind of some of the attributes of it are the same as with Lies in terms of pace and speed and that sort of thing.
So tell us about Sarah in this book.
Well, Sarah is she's a young mother. She's in her early 30s. She's an academic. She's trying to kind of get on the next rung on the ladder at work, and she finds herself in a really, really difficult situation with sort of an impossible situation with her boss, basically, who is very powerful within the university where they work. He is very, very well known. He's internationally acclaimed. He's a TV star with his own show. That's the public face of him. And the other side of him is that he's also a serial abuser, harasser of women. And he basically says to her, makes it very clear to her that if she doesn't, give him what he wants, then he will basically destroy her career. So she starts off in a really, really difficult place. And that's the kind of starting point of the story with her, thinking it's time for her to kind of move up in her career, a bit more security, and him basically saying, no, this is how it's going to be, and if you don't play my game, then you'll be out the door, sort of thing. So.
And the sad reality, as we've seen in the news over the last few years, is many women can possibly relate to some of that situation.
Yeah, I mean, I was writing it started in 2016, so it came out, I sort of finished the first draft in last summer in 2017, and then the Weinstein scandal kind of hit and Me Too, and so it was really, really uncanny to see, all these kind of stories played out in the media. Obviously, this kind of thing has been happening for decades or longer, but it's, to have that visibility at the same time, it's been very weird to see, and a lot of the themes are the same, and the things that happen in my story are kind of, there's kind of elements of it that are, that are from a thriller, but there are lots of things also that I think people can probably relate to from their own situations. So.
Mm. The interesting thing I think about sexual harassment is it's very difficult to define. You know, rape is rape, and it's hard to kind of get away from that. But sexual harassment, some people might determine a comment to be inappropriate. You know, oh, that blouse looks very nice on you or whatever. But for others, you know, grabbing someone's bottom, you know, that would be crossing the line. But it's very different. It's not black and white at all, is it?
No, and I think sometimes so the situation with that Sarah finds herself in again is all the structures of, you know, the place where she works, all of the whole way it's set up is against her effectively. So, you know, her everything is kind of in her boss's favour. He has all the power. He holds all the cards basically, because people will always believe him over her. And even if they suspect something is going on, he's far, far too valuable to the organisation to let go. So they're much more inclined to sort of sweep things under the carpet and, you know, get rid of people who are causing an issue. So all those structural things are kind of working against her. Everything is really working against her at the start of the story. So,
and again, I bet that's very common as well. It's the powerful ones that are often doing these things.
Yeah. So I think we've seen with Harvey Weinstein and all the other people who have been implicated, they have this kind of power of not life and death, but they have the kind of power of over people's careers and over, you know, he had lots of power over the careers of actresses, and what he said went in Hollywood for a long time, and he had the power to sort of make or break people effectively, and lots of people, you know, lots and lots of victims. You know, over decades of the sort of thing he was doing. So, but Sarah's obviously in the story. She's presented through a series of events in the story. She's presented with this offer from a stranger, another character, powerful man, who says, "Look, I can." She basically does something for him, and he says, "I'm going to repay you by, you know, giving you this offer." And the offer is just give him one name, and he will make that person vanish off the face of the earth, basically. So he'll make him disappear. So she then finds herself thinking, well, of course I'm not going to do that. And then things get so bad with her situation that she starts to think, well, you know, why not? Why shouldn't I do that?
Mm. And do you think people will be rooting for her and wanting her to do it?
I hope so. I mean, I think, you know, writing it, I think we've all had, you know, the situations where we think, well, I know what's probably right. I know what I should do, but here's what I want to do, and here's what I wish would happen. Kind of,
yeah.
So it's kind of the clash between, you know, what your head is saying and what your heart is saying, and I think that's quite an interesting area, that kind of grey area between right and wrong, and doing things, you know, that we know are wrong or questionable, but the kind of for the right reasons. And so it's a kind of interesting area for a thriller to explore, I think. And he obviously says to her, look, there's no chance you'll be found out, there's absolutely no come back to you, no connection to you, so you can make this happen and it will never come back on you. So this is kind of sort of Faustian bargain that she's offered, kind of devil's pact, to you know, help her situation. So initially she's obviously thinking, well, there's no way I'm going to take that. But then, as I say, things deteriorate even further. And so she's then gets to a point where she's, you know, seriously considering doing it. So.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Was it a fun book to write?
Yeah, you know, it's a great story to write. And, you know, like I say, lots of things in there that have kind of crossed my mind over the years. You know, not with any particular people, but I think, you know, everybody's had a situation where they've just kind of got to the end of their tether, and but it was a lot of fun to write and to kind of develop the story and one of the best things about it is trying to surprise people and trying to you know, put some twists in there that people are really not expecting. And when you read, you know, people's reviews, or when people talk to you and say, wow, I was really not expecting that, or, you know, that was an incredible twist at the end, that's a really kind of rewarding feeling for me as a writer to have really thrown people and surprised people, which I think some people have with Lies as well. So
yeah. And how did you find getting into the head of Sarah and to try and work out and understand how she'd be feeling throughout all of this?
I think I kind of have worked in the past with lots of women. So I worked in communications, which is kind of a field that's heavily dominated by women. So I had lots of women who were my colleagues, and I would just try and put myself, you know, in the head of one of them, or you know, I'd talk to my wife about it and try to imagine, you know, what it was like to be in that situation. And I think, you know, a man might approach things, I mean, the thing is with you know, the male perspective would be different because they probably wouldn't be faced with this situation, but I just tried to sort of get into the head of someone who's facing this kind of thing, and I sort of drew on the people that I knew, people I'd worked with, you know, my wife's kind of experience and background, and tried to make it as real as possible. So
So have you already thought about the next book?
Yeah, so the next book three, is on its way. So I'm going to be finishing by the end of next month, or first draft at least. And that's called Don't Look Down, and it'll be coming out at some point in the early part of 2019. So.
Great, exciting. So you're enjoying life as an author at the moment?
Yeah, no, it's excellent. It's really fun. It's kind of it's taken me a long time to get here, but It's great, just to, you know, my daughter says, you know, you don't have a real job, you just sit in the spare room making stuff up. So, which is...
and get paid kind of for true. It.
Yeah, exactly, which is that is true. And but I think she's fine. She's kind of getting around to the idea of this is sort of my job now. So.
Yeah, because you worked in journalism for many years. This must be, although there's similarities, obviously, this must be very different.
Yeah, I was a journalist, and I worked in communications and PR sometime after that. But I mean, there's a few things that help having been a journalist. So you know, deadlines, and obviously, you know, literally writing every day, and having people comment on your work and improve your work is a big, I think that's a big plus, because obviously that happens every day as well. When you're writing for a newspaper, there are always people there who can probably make what you do a bit better, and that's been a kind of big part of the process of being an author as well, of being able to listen to, you know, comments of other people and incorporate their thoughts into the work. So being a journalist, I think, did help me kind of get to where I am. So,
well, if people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called 29 Seconds, and it's by T.M. Logan, who we've been chatting to today. Tim, thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE. We let our programs do the talking.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Lydia Sisson. She began her career as a BBC World Service radio producer and has since written three critically acclaimed historical novels for young adults, each in some way inspired by the radical backgrounds of earlier generations of her family. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel. It's called Mr. Peacock's Possessions. It's her debut literary fiction novel for adults, and it's based on the incredible true story of one of her husband's ancestors, Tom Bell. It's described as part Swiss Family Robinson and part Lord of the Flies, and it explores timeless themes of family relationships, faith and belonging. Welcome to the book show, Lydia.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And what an interesting story this seems. Before we talk about the book, can you tell us a little bit about Tom Bell and what you found out about him?
Well, the story grabbed me really the moment I heard it. My husband's aunt was staying from New Zealand, and we don't see much of his family at all. And so, as you said, I've used some of my own family for my previous books. And I wasn't looking for a book. I just wanted to know more for our children, really, about his side of the family. And blow me down, she started telling me the story about her uncle, who she used to spend all her holidays with him and her aunt, who was called King Bell, and had been born on an island in the Pacific in the middle of nowhere. I mean, if you look on the map, which of course I did as soon as I could, you see these sort of, it's about 1,500 miles stretching northeast of New Zealand, and it looks like it's all blue and nothing, but actually there's this tiny, tiny volcanic island chain, and his family decided to settle there. It was completely uninhabited. They claimed the island for themselves it was 1878, and when they first arrived, they had six children aged 1 to 11, which was just incredible to me.
What on earth made them go there, do you think?
Well, I think it's the same drive that makes so many people move around the world. I mean, I think we're all migrants, really. I mean, I think, it's a human species or a migrating species, not maybe in the same way as whales, but everybody is looking for something better so often. And the family had been settlers. The parents had both come from England and met in New Zealand. They'd tried their luck in different parts of New Zealand. They'd gone to Tonga to try and set up a trading station. They'd run a hotel in Samoa. And they heard about this empty island. It was incredibly fertile because of being volcanic. It had been an important place for whalers because it was the only sort of pit stop in the ocean for hundreds of miles, and although the harbourage and landing was very difficult, it did have water and wood, which is what whalers needed. But he was persuaded that he could have sheep and they could grow fruit and nothing didn't grow, and off they set. But when it wasn't quite as easy and paradise as it had sounded. It's a subtropical island. It's the meeting of climate zones, the meeting of tectonic plates. It's a real sort of crossroads in the ocean. And when they landed, the winds were in the wrong direction, and they were dumped on a much more difficult side of the island than they'd anticipated, surrounded by these incredibly high cliffs. And the ship sailed away, and they were expecting it to come back in about 3 months with their provisions and maybe to take them off the island if they didn't feel they could make a go of it. But no sooner did they open the tins of provisions that the captain had sold them, but they discovered that he'd really sold them a puck, and the flour was mouldy, the beans were full of weevils. They had nothing to eat, and they were trapped by these cliffs. They survived on giant limpets for the first week, and a couple of a few sandwiches and some cake that the ship's cook had given them.
Gosh, that's unbelievable. And they were there for a while until they were evacuated during the First World War. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, it was a long story. It was about 8 months before they saw anybody else again, and a whaler ship came by. And after a series of terrible disasters, sort of rat infestations and so on, and it was such a struggle to go and get the goats. So the goats were left on all sorts of Pacific islands in those days and left to go feral so that there would be something for castaways. But they'd moved to the other side of the island. And after about 2 years, a gang of Pacific Islanders from a Polynesian island called Niue came to help them. And I discovered this from a book that a journalist in the 1950s had written on the basis of interviews with the second youngest daughter, who was 8 when she arrived on the island. And there was very little said about these. And these were the holes that really intrigued me and got me going with my story. Because when I then started to do a lot more research to find out who these islanders might have been and why they'd come, I discovered that their island had been converted wholesale to Christianity in a generation. It was a sort of poster boy for the London Missionary Society, if an island can be a poster boy. I'm not quite sure about that metaphor. But it was a kind of huge success story. And so what I found I had to start my story was these two very different migrant groups meeting on this island in the middle of nowhere, and then not finding remotely, having all their expectations overturned, because the Pacific Islanders were literate, very God-fearing, they didn't work on Sundays, and here was this somewhat wild family, barefooted. The children couldn't read or write. The father drank. It was a sort of very unexpected kind of confrontation, and not at all the sort of stereotypes of South Sea Islands that you get in, well, especially from 19th century fiction for boys and Stevenson and so on. That's what really interested me. But the family did stay there for a long time, on and off. Every so often they'd go, because eventually the island was actually annexed by New Zealand, and then New Zealand tried to send other settlers there, which was all disastrous as well. and poor old Thomas Bell is left making these obsessive claims against the New Zealand government, and it was sort of really a bit of a tragedy because he was so obsessed with getting his island back, and they kept having to face disasters. They were taken off at one point in, I think, 1911 after a huge cyclone had completely destroyed everything they'd built again. So they were constantly starting from scratch during all that time. And in fact, my aunt remembered that in the room bedroom where she stayed in King Bell, he was called King Bell because he was king of the Kermadecs. That's the name of this island chain. His real name was William, but in the spare bedroom in their house in New Zealand, Mrs. Bell's ashes were kept in a cupboard because she always wanted to be sprinkled on this island. It was called Sunday Island then. It's called Raoul Island now, but none of the children ever went back.
Wow. Isn't that interesting? And did they not go back because they didn't really have happy memories there? They didn't want to go back?
I think it was just, I mean, it's still the most incredibly difficult place to get to. I actually was lucky enough to go there myself in November with an expedition, but I had to go with the New Zealand Navy, and it was an expedition organised by an environmental organisation for young people called the Sir Peter Blake Trust, and so I was with this group of young environmentalists and scientists. But although it's a really important part of the world in terms of science and the environment, and there's a big plan proposal at the moment that's under consultation with the New Zealand government to turn it into what would be one of the world's largest ocean sanctuaries, the Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary. But because it's such an unusual place, but even the scientists at the moment can only get there on these very opportunistic expeditions because it's so far away and so difficult to get to, and now only inhabited by workers from the Department of Conservation who are trying to restore it or keep it, restore it back to how it was before settlers, because mostly to try and bring back the birds that used to be there and get the breeding populations up of particularly endemic species like the Kermadec petrel.
Fantastic.
So it's an absolutely fascinating place and a kind of bellwether in terms of climate change and so on.
With such an amazing story then, why did you decide to turn it into fiction?
Well, I think for the reason I mentioned, really because of the holes that, you know, these islanders that came were not named. My aunt had said that the book by Elsie Morton called The Crusoes of Sunday Island was a very sanitized account, and that actually the father, who Elsie Morton described as an iron-willed despot, was even more brutal than the book suggests. And she told me about another brother that she knew, the second youngest brother, Roy, who actually was turned into a very respected ornithologist and helped a scientific expedition that went there in 1908 a great deal. But the family story that she'd been told, and you know, family stories are family stories. It doesn't mean they're necessarily true. She'd been told that he was crippled because of his father's brutality. And, you know, and that the father drank and he would go to Auckland to get supplies and not come back for ages. And, I mean, she's recorded that he abandoned the whole family, the younger children, for, you know, for months on end. There was one point, I think, when they were just teenagers left on the island.
Gosh, that's awful.
It was those family relationships really that really intrigued me. What would it, you know, what was it like to be a family that isolated, and what would it have been like to have been one of the children who was in a more privileged position? I think I was really interested in, so my story follows most closely one of the Pacific Islanders, Kalala, whose brother is an ordained, they were called native teachers, but the London Missionary Society trained up islanders to go and send them to other islands to do the work of conversion. And so Kalala and his brother, and then there are four other young men, other people who come and help the Peacock family in my book, In Mr. Peacock's Possessions. And there's this moment of encounter that happens that changes the way that Lizzie, who is the other main character that I follow, who's the second oldest daughter and has been Mr. Peacock's golden girl, because of course he depended on her when they first arrived. She was the great, strong, brave girl who would leap up the cliffs and help kill the goats and, you know, always supported her father, who was charismatic in the way that obsessive people often are. But there's this moment when one of her brothers disappears. This is in the book I'm talking about. This is a Mr. Peacock's Possessions, not in real life, not the Bell family story. This is where I deviate completely from historical reality. And a child disappears, and it causes her to look at her father in a completely different way. Mm. And I think that's something that's common to lots of families. You know, families are often like islands. Islands are a great gift for writers because, you know, they offer both setting and metaphor, and they kind of keep everybody in one place in a very satisfying way. But I think it's that moment when you look at a parent and who you've admired and loved and adored, and you suddenly see they've got feet of clay, and then suddenly perhaps you realise that your own position of privilege in a family has caused you to see what's happening, to distort, has actually distorted your vision of what's happening in the family, and you haven't understood or haven't appreciated what it's like to be another member of the family who perhaps is not getting treated quite so well.
Yes. Oh, it's a fantastic story. Has it inspired you to write more adult fiction?
I'm really pondering about where to go next, because I've written adult non-fiction and I've written YA fiction. I've written for younger children as well, and I love doing both. And the great thing with history is that sometimes you feel like you're hardly making anything up, because history itself can be so extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I do really, really love the research process. That's absolutely kind of foundational to the way I write. So but then fiction gives you a kind of freedom to explore things and to draw parallels that maybe real life doesn't. And so I'm thinking about my next steps at the moment. There are various ideas I've got, and there's one particular idea that's actually to do with another member of my own family that I can't quite decide whether it will work better as fiction or non-fiction.
Well, I think you're very lucky both to have options in the kind of books that you can write and also to have such interesting family members.
I think it has been a bit of a gift, actually. I feel at some point I'm going to run out, but there are still quite a few that I've got to explore, and it's a lovely way of finding out about family. But I found out much more about my husband's family as well, and sort of fascinating stuff that goes way back. I didn't realize quite how many generations of a New Zealander he is, because he's actually brought up in this country, and you wouldn't really think he was a New Zealander at all.
Brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of Mr. Peacock's Possessions, it's out now, and it is by Lydia Sisson, who we've been chatting to. Lydia, thank you so much for joining us.
That was a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio Europe.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce, who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
At the UPS Store, we know being a small business owner means holiday time is still go time. Still get those orders shipped time. And still re-up on stamps and supplies time. That's why this upcoming holiday, while others close up shop, we'll be open. And happy to help you keep being unstoppable. Come into your local store today. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS Store. Be unstoppable.